Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
It was a slow day, no rounds to make. Just an occasional glance at the bottle of port which had begun glowing faintly. I took several walks and visited briefly with Greymork. She had nothing new to report. Strolled around Rastov's place, but Quicklime was nowhere in sight. Sniffed about Morris and McCabs, but Nightwind had retired somewhere for the day. Walked up to Larry's to keep him current on events, but he was out. Wandered over to the good doctor's storm-crowned quarters, but there was no activity there that was viewable from without. Made my way to the great detective's domicile, but all was quiet at the manse. I couldn't really tell whether he was there or not. Passed the church and the vicarage a couple of times, and Takeda saw me the second time by and flew away. Went back home and ate. Took a nap.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Strange Studies of Strange Stories meditation app. That reading was from the beginning of the chapter covering October 26th in Roger Zelazny's novel, A Night in the Lonesome October.
It was a nice change of pace from last week's Nightmare Fest. I'm sure the rest of the book is going to be just as peaceful.
Well, I'm sorry. That paragraph is what they call the calm before the storm in the story business, a business we are all too acquainted with here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. You're joining us here on Patreon as we conclude our discussion. Let's have a thunderclap to remind us what kind of book this is.
Oh, dear, a pipe organ as well.
Oh, man.
That means things are going to get scary. Zoinks!
Jinkies!
Our reader was once again Jason Rainbird. If I understand it correctly, he's showing up to your game every week in a different costume. So did he thrill you this time? Did he chill you? What happened?
This week, this is probably his best yet. Ooh. This last costume was a doozy. He showed up as the invisible man, and he was actually invisible. I could not see him.
What?
I don't know what his trick was. I don't know what he was doing. He texted me. Uh-huh. I said, I'm there at the game. And I'm like, but I can't see you. I can't see you. And I kept saying it. You know, he didn't talk back. He wouldn't, I guess, because that would let us know where he was at in the room.
Yeah.
So he would text me secretly. And I said, oh, where are you? Are you over in this corner? And he goes, go check. And then I go over there and I move my arms around it, and there was nothing. And I couldn't hear any sound. I don't know how he was so quiet and how he was invisible. It was amazing.
I have goosebumps right now.
Yeah.
I hope Jason's not in here looking at him. Check your texts.
Oh, text him right now.
I am entertaining the possibility he just didn't show up. But I don't want to be a party pooper.
What?
Let's sum up the story so far briefly.
The tale is told by Jack the Ripper's dog, Snuff. Wait, you really don't think he showed up?
Man, that's a 1% possibility that's the game he was playing.
Huh. The tale is told by Jack the Ripper's dog, Snuff. He and the other characters are playing a game in which the stakes are all of the Earth.
Some of them are planning to open a gate to Lovecraftian horrors that will invade our world, which can only be done on Halloween night when a full moon is in the sky, which doesn't happen that often.
Jack is a closer, meaning he's trying to keep the Lovecraftian horrors out. We're not sure exactly who is an opener and who is a closer, but the players are Jack with Snuff the Dog, Crazy Jill with Greymalk the Cat, Morrison McCab with Nightwind the Owl, and the Good Doctor with Bubo the Rat, and lastly, the Vicar, a Mythos cultist with Tekla the Albino Raven. Some of the players are dead, murdered, out of the game, but most likely killed by the Vicar. Those players are Rastov with Quicklime the Snake.
The Snake survived, but has retired to the woods.
The Count with Needle the Bat, and Owen the Druid with Cheater the Squirrel.
The squirrel also survived and has also retired as he's gained his shadow back from the druid who took it away and made him super intelligent. At the end of the last episode, that was our last paragraph, he scampered away to live his normal animal life. It was kind of like the squirrel version of Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah. We also have Larry Talbot, the werewolf and the great detective who has been in disguise as Lady Enderby and is trying to solve these murders, although he's not actually part of the game.
I deduce he will have some role to play.
Yeah.
There's also the monster whom the good doctor has reanimated from the stitched together remains of the dead, a large, strong zombie man who likes to pet kittens.
Well, who doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
After being almost vivisected in our last episode, Snuff the Dog kicks off October 26th with just having a chill day.
As we heard in that opening, which really was a nice change of pace because of all that relentless action last time, but this restfulness doesn't last for long.
Restless that night, he goes out into the woods just to track some foxes.
Yeah, he's basically out doing dog practice. He scares off some rabbits, he pees on some things. You gotta always keep fresh on the basics if you want to be a good boy.
While in the woods, Snuff runs into a large wolf that he thinks is Larry, Talbot at first, but it's not. This large wolf explains to Larry that he's thinking of spending the winter in these woods, and he's checking them out. He asks Snuff if they're safe, these woods, and Snuff says, sure, if you keep your head down, but maybe come back after a week because things need to calm down. Stuff's going on.
Yeah, Snuff says, exercise a little discretion when you take a sheep or a pig. Don't leave carcasses in plain sight and stay away from any human gatherings on Halloween. The new wolf asks, well, why? And Snuff says, because it might get you killed. Or worse. And then he just splits. Snuff likes to be a man of mystery.
The wolf says, Snuff, wait! As Snuff runs off into the woods. And he thinks, wait, how does this wolf know my name?
It's that old trope. You knew my name, but I didn't tell you my name.
Snuff runs off and is able to lose the other big wolf.
That's the end of the chapter. And it was obvious to me that this other large wolf was significant in some way.
The next chapter covers October 27th. In the morning, Grandma comes over to tell Snuff about the fire that broke over at the good doctor's place. They're not sure if the good doctor, his assistant, or the monster escaped, or if they're dead, so they decide to go check it out.
Yeah, some huge fire the night before. Snuff says it was odd coming on the place without a storm raging overhead. That's what he says as they approached the blackened, smoky farmhouse. If you remember, I thought it was really cool that there was a perpetual storm raging just above the doctor's house. Mm-hmm. At first, I thought it was just an effect, but then in our last episode, Jack's house was attacked by that storm. Mm. And I had thought, oh, wait a minute. Maybe the doctor has some kind of weather controlling device or something. I mean, that's something a mad scientist might have.
Sure. Snuff sniffs around, but he can't find any bodies, though they might have been destroyed in the fire. They do find Bubo the rat, who says that the fire started when the monster had a tantrum and destroyed the lab.
So pretty typical Frankensteinian drama. Mm-hmm. Monster gets mad, things burn down. Bubo doesn't call Frankenstein's creation the monster, by the way, as I did a bit ago. Mm-hmm. He calls him the Experiment Man, which I thought was kind of a cool name for him.
It sounds like an old blues guy.
The Experiment Man.
Bubo then confesses that he was never a player in the game.
Wait, what? I thought that was a cool development.
Yes, I didn't see that coming.
No.
Bubo saw all the other animals talking about stuff, and he decided he wanted to find out what was going on. And by eavesdropping, he figured out quite a bit, enough to fool them all.
For a second, I hoped he would rip off a disguise and reveal that he's been a mechanical owl the whole time, just to show all those know-it-all listeners I was praising on episode 3. Bunch of lymph node bubonic plague experts. But no, he says, hey, I'm just a pack rat. So getting in with the pack, that's kind of my deal. He says, I got the idea pretty quick that there was some sort of strange game going on and you were all players. You had it all pretty good and you left each other alone, even helped each other sometimes. So I decided to learn as much as I could and figure out how I could pass for one of you. I realized pretty quickly that you all had pretty weird masters and mistresses. And then I knew I could do it. Because I'd been hanging around the good doctor's place already for the leftovers from his work. So I led on that he was in the game and that I worked for him. Sure enough, I got respect and decent treatment from the rest of you. It made life a lot easier. He doesn't have anything to do with the doctor, really. And the doctor doesn't have anything to do with the game. Bubo was just there to eat up on Experiment Man's extra booty pieces. That was his whole deal.
It's true. Snuff is actually happy about this because that means the good doctor isn't a player and that's why his calculations were off. So now he can figure out the actual location of the ritual, which has been a mystery up to this point. Snuff offers Bubo a place to stay at their house, and Bubo accepts.
So Bubo, yeah, he can't really retire because there's nothing to retire from. He just wants to stay involved somehow. And, you know, Snuff, in all of these instances, has been offering the other animals spots at his house or some companionship when they're knocked out of the game, which I thought is really nice. And I've watched lots of YouTube videos where dogs do adopt other animals. So it's also a dose of hyper-realism in this story. But this was all neat because just like me thinking the storm was the doctor's work, which it turns out it wasn't, I was just making assumptions, you know, and these things weren't spelled out. And that's a twist or rather a development that I can definitely get behind. Mm-hmm. Also, it now makes an earlier question I had make sense when I was like, what's the deal with the doctor? Does he just wander around creating experiment men everywhere? Mm-hmm. Like, if he's playing the game, why is he also doing that? And Snuff realizes, oh, the doctor actually just came out here because he wanted a little privacy for his work.
Right.
Just like Jason Rainbird accused me of following him from the shadows a few weeks ago. And I was like, dude, I'm not following you. I'm just looking a little privacy for my work. What's more private than the shadows?
That's a good point. Now we turn the page to October 28th, getting close to Halloween.
At the beginning of this chapter, Snuff is now rerunning the pattern, walking it to find the center for the game. Now that the doctor is out, he sees the vicar while he's out, still with a bandage on his ear from when Snuff bit into him. And then he sees one of my favorite images in the book. It's the detective disguised as Mrs. Enderby hiding up in a tree with a pair of binoculars. Talk about scoping and loping. The detective says, Snuff, please come here. But Snuff ignores him.
Bubo moves in to Jack's house, living mostly in the basement, but coming up to the main house when everybody's away, and he also eats with Snuff. Bubo has a lot of questions about the game, things he couldn't figure out. Snuff asks him what he knows, and Bubo tells him.
And he proceeded to tell me the story of how a number of the proper people are attracted to the proper place in the proper year on a night in the lonesome October, when the moon shines full on Halloween and the way may be open for the return of the elder gods to Earth, and of how some of these people would assist in the opening of the way for them, while others would strive to keep the way closed. For ages, the closers have won, often just barely, and there were stories of a shadowy man, half mad, a killer, a wanderer, and his dog, who always showed up to attempt the closing. Some said that it was Cain himself, doomed to walk the earth, marked. Others said he'd pact with one of the elders who secretly wished to thwart the others. None really knew. And the people would acquire certain tools and other objects of power, meet together at the designated spot, and attempt to work their wills. The winners walked away. The losers suffered for their presumption by a reaction from the cosmic principles involved in the attempt. Then he named the players and their tools, adding an awareness of the calculation, of divinations, of magical attacks and defenses.
Snuff is impressed, and so am I. He figured out a lot of stuff.
That is as clearly as the whole thing's been articulated in the whole book. Yeah. Bubo is very modest to say, yeah, you know, I picked up a few things. Picked up more than me. And also by calling Jack a killer, though, he kind of confirms that this is no spring-heeled scaremonger. This is Jack the Ripper, which we knew.
They go out and scout around. He goes up to the dog's nest to look around at the layout. And now the good doctor is out of the equation. Snuff can see the location of the ritual will be the dog's nest, where he is.
That's the very place he's been using. It's a little hill to get a view of the area throughout the book. It's why he's labeled it the dog's nest, because that's his place. But it's also where he and the cat went on a magical journey across Lovecraft's dreamlands through a magical gate that appeared in a rock, which I do believe also might have been a clue that this is a special spot.
Yeah.
But Snuff howls since he's finally got it all worked out. Oh, did it. The dog's nest is where the game's going to be played. Although the dog's nest does sound like a reality show where like Snoop Dogg raises some orphans in a treehouse or something. Did you get those kids high again, Snoop? Wiggity ziggity. That's what he says, right?
I don't think so.
The Dog's Nest, premiering tonight on Ding Dong Tron, right after Schwarzenegger's Dracula. See, I'm trying to tie up all my loose ends, too, from this series of shows.
You're doing great.
Thanks.
That night at midnight, Snuff tells Jack that he's got the location. They both are a bit sad that Jill and Greymalk are closers, but they both want to try and be friends with them up until the end.
It's confirmed that they're closers, and that was also something I was worried about on a previous episode. If it didn't get cut, I mentioned it, because I was shipping Greymalk and Snuff, but I was worried they'd end up star-crossed, have a fight, be opposite, something like that. I have to give you some praise, dude. You were way ahead of me in this book, and you never spoiled anything for me when I was flying off with those comments.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad. On October 29th, Jack and Snuff go over to Jill's for a meal. It's delicious. I kept wondering if eating food from the opposition was a good idea.
Yeah, same here, but I would have been real mad as a reader if Jack and Snuff had been this smart for this long and then suddenly were tricked by something that like dumb guys like you and I could see through.
Right.
Jack even asks her while they're having the meal, you know, would you consider switching sides to the witch? And she says, no, I'm going to finish how I started, even though she does feel a little conflicted now that they're all getting along so well. Mm-hmm. Snuff says it felt odd to be dining with the enemy and to care about them that much. And it's not in the text, but I bet he snuck over and sniffed that broom a few more times. Snuff,
oh, God.
What are you doing? Sniffing seat, Snuff?
Later, Snuff goes to the ruins of the good doctor's farmhouse and he finds Needle in the barn.
Needle's just chilling up there and also seems to have a lot of information. I was trying to remember, there might have been a scene, but Needle didn't retire like the snake and the squirrel. I don't think we found out where he went.
No, we did not. Needle tells Snuff that Owen, before being killed, tried to talk Rastov into becoming an opener, but it didn't work. Rastov could have been an ally for Jack.
He could have been on their side, so it's too bad that he's dead. You sound as if you're still in the game, Snuff says.
But before they can talk further, they are attacked by the vicar.
A crossbow bolt flies into the burnt-up barn. He's after the both of them.
Needles tries to distract the vicar while he reloads the crossbow, and Snuff has to try and climb down a ladder. He drops a bit to avoid being shot, and just then, the great detective in his Lady Enderby disguise shows up.
Why, Vicar Roberts, whatever are you doing with that archaic weapon?
Snuff sees that this is his opportunity to play the happy, smiley dog, and he trots over to her. She defends Snuff's character, and this causes the vicar to let him go. Why does he care what she thinks?
Yeah.
She somewhat threatens to expose him, but why not just kill her? Because this guy's a murderer.
You know, I think it's like when we had those drug dealers who hung out on our stoop in Santa Monica. Like, I was never really worried about them messing with us because we weren't in the game. It's kind of a similar thing. And the vicar has to keep up the front of being the vicar and being this righteous religious man, because otherwise some cops might show up and nab him, because there is still a couple of days left. I was asking the same question, but it's not quite Halloween yet.
So the vicar leaves and the detective drops the act and starts talking to the dog. He's pieced together a lot of what's going on and tells Snuff that he knows that he's not just a dumb dog. But Snuff keeps up the act. The detective knows a lot, and he tells Snuff that he's on his side. Saving his life proves it. So finally, Snuff nods in agreement.
Sherlock Holmes basically telling the dog, hey, I know you can think, so drop the act. That was also a very amusing scene to me.
And he's also dressed up like an old lady while this is going on.
It's amazing. I was a little annoyed when he was in the story, but the fact that they relied heavily on the disguises, had him hiding in some trees with binoculars, and then reasoning with dogs, I was like, okay, this is a good use of Sherlock Holmes, actually. This is new ground for this character.
The detective suggests interfering with the ritual, but Snuff shakes his head. The detective knows that the vicar is going to murder his stepdaughter as part of the ritual, and Snuff communicates that he doesn't want that to happen. He takes his little paw and he writes the initials LT in the dirt. The detective gets Larry Talbot is going to rescue her. So the detective says that he knows what's up with Larry and that he doesn't think the drugs are going to help him as much as he thinks they are. Also, Vicar Roberts knows about Larry and has made silver bullets to use on the night of the ritual.
He's always one step ahead. He's been studying these plants that Larry's studying as well. It seems like maybe there's something going on there, but clearly the detective is really only interested in saving the girl that's going to be sacrificed.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's not like he's going to call the police and bring these monsters up on charges for playing a scary supernatural Halloween game. So this is what his vested interest is. And Snuff shows him the dog's nest where it's all going to go down. That sounds so dirty. Snuff shows him the dog's nest. But then we jump ahead into October 30th, Devil's Night.
Oh, my God.
As it's known here in the States. I hope that there would maybe be a late in the game addition since it's Devil's Night and the crow would show up. But because he does have a familiar, also a crow.
He does, yeah. But it's black, not white.
That's true.
But that would have been perfect.
Yeah.
There are preparations to be made, and we get a pretty specific description of how the ritual works, specifically from Snuff.
Those of us who remain will gather atop the hill at midnight. We will bring kindling, and we will cooperate in the building of a big fire. Then, we will position ourselves in an arc before the thing our divinations have shown us to be the gateway, which we've already determined to be the stone bearing the inscription. The openers and their friends will stand at one end of the arc, the closers at the other. All will have brought the tools they intend to employ. Some of these are neutral, such as the ring, the pentacle, the icon, to take their character of opening or closing from the hands of those who wield them. Others, the two wands, one for opening, one for closing, will naturally be held by those of these persuasions. Jill holds the opening wand, my master, the closing wand. The forces of the neutral objects will support the efforts of that side for which they're employed. Which makes the outcome sound like a simple mathematical affair, but it isn't. The strength of the individual counts for much, and these affairs seem to generate strange byplay as well, which contributes to overall dispositions of power. And then there's the matter of experience. Theoretically, everything should be conducted at a metaphysical level, but this is seldom really the case. Still, no matter how physical it may get, the reputation attached to Jack and his knife generally grants us considerable protection against mundane violence. We tend to maintain our positions in the arc once the ceremony has begun, and sometimes things happen to the players during its course. There's a sort of psychic circuit established among us. It need not be disastrous to break the Ark, though it may be a courting of mischance somewhere along the line. Preliminary rites will begin, as a matter of individual choice, often at odds with one another. The power will build and build. Psychic attacks may be shot back and forth. Disasters may follow. Players may fall or go mad, catch fire, be transformed. The gateway may begin to open at any time, or it may await the invitation of the opening wand. The resistance will begin immediately. The closing wand will be employed, and any ancillary forces that may feed it. Eventually, at the end of our exercises, which may take only a little while, though conceivably they could last until dawn, and in such a stalemated case, the closers would win by default. The matter will be decided. Bad things happen to the losers.
Well, that's all very simple. Oh, you mean a game. Listening to that, that's how I feel anytime someone's explaining the rules of a board game to me.
Okay. Well, some of this is going to play out, obviously, and that's why I thought it was important to read that. Retained any of it, good
luck. Well, they've been talking about this event the whole time, so it's nice to hear it spelled out. Yeah. Okay, this is what's going to go down.
Seth tries to find Larry to warn him about the silver bullets, but he finds him in some sort of meditative state that he can't wake him from.
He's listening to the Strange Studies of Strange Stories meditation app. See? Bringing it all around.
Wow.
Teeing things up for the big day. Here we go.
October 31st. We're at the big day now. Snuff talks to Greymulk, and there is a sadness in it. She says that Jill is going to protest against the sacrificing of the girl, but she'll most likely be outvoted.
Right, because all the openers are actually going to get together for a little pre-game meeting. It was hinted at before that this whole game might be asymmetrical, this event.
Yeah.
And it definitely is, because Jack and Snuff are the only closers against everybody else. We know that Larry and the detective are around and they're probably going to try and help, but it's going to be an uphill battle.
Greymulk tells Snuff that during the ritual, he needs to be in a specific place. And he wonders why she's making this request, but he remembers that she has the dream cat helping her. And he believes that she is trying to protect Snuff, so he's going to take her advice. Quicklime shows up with one little last bit of information. The Count is still around.
Don't count me out! I predicted that one too, and you didn't spoil it for me.
I didn't.
I knew the Count couldn't be so easily destroyed. I just knew it. It turns out that he planted a skeleton with a stake there, which is rad.
It dressed him up in his clothes and everything. He totally faked his death, and he was the one who killed the druid. He's been hiding with the gypsies, which is something I think you said earlier on, that might be the thing with him.
Let's check the record, yeah.
Because the calculations were made before his believed death, they're still valid. Everything's still going on as planned at the right place. Snuff suspects that the Count might actually be a closer.
Which also kind of goes back to our first show, because you were icked out by Jack the Ripper being a hero, you know, as a serial killer. And I was countering that Dracula is one of history's greatest mass murderers. So guess what? He's a hero too. So, I think we've all learned something.
Yeah, there you go. I guess. The day passes, and just before midnight, Jack and Snuff go to the dog's nest. Vicar Roberts and Morris and McCab are there tending to the ritual bonfire. They politely greet one another. Lynette is lying on the altar, all drugged out. No sign of Jill or Greymulk yet. Nightwind is there and asks Snuff if he wishes to switch sides. Snuff asks him the same. Neither do. The albino raven, Tekla, shows up, and she gives Snuff the cold shoulder. So not even any niceties there between those two.
No.
Finally, Jill arrives with Greymulk, and they take their places in the Ark. The time is midnight, and Snuff can talk to Jack.
All the animals can talk to everybody now, which means the game is officially underway.
The markings on the ancient stone begin to glow. The vicar removes the pinnacle bowl and the Alhazred icon. McCab removes a sacrificial knife. Just then, the Count appears, and he stands at Jack's side of the Ark. He is indeed a closer. And he says, I like the world just as it is.
That's his justification for being a closer. And when you think about it, that makes sense, because when it's all elder things and Cthulhu's stalking the earth, you know, Dracula looks pretty silly. He's just a dude in an opera cape at that point.
And if all the people get eaten by the monsters, who's he going to eat? Whose blood is he going to drink?
Nobody's. That's whose.
The stone glows more and a rectangle gateway opens. The vicar is ready to sacrifice the girl when a great wolf shows up. It's Larry!
Yay! I knew that was coming, but I was so happy it finally happened.
He grabs the girl and he pulls her off the altar, but the vicar shoots Larry a few times. Larry tries to drag her further, but he's down.
Down for the count.
The chanting continues and Morris and McCab leave the Ark to get the girl back on the altar. The Count points out that they cannot move the sacrifice once the ceremony is in progress. Jack says the place where the body falls becomes the new altar. The vicar says that they're lying and has them do it anyway. So as they begin to move her, the Count moves out of the Ark and he kills Morris and McCab. The vicar screams out to the Count, "You can't do that!" And the Count slowly turns to him, "You presume to address me so?"
Ah, nice. That's the way it should sound. Yeah. I've been making some terrible jokes on this series, so I'm not going to spoil that cool moment by doing any Schwarzenegger voices. That was some really cool Count Dracula stuff.
Yeah, there. Yeah, that's what I wanted, and I got some. And while all that's going on, Snuff gets a whiff of yet someone else, and it's the other wolf.
Airwolf!
No. The wolf that he was talking to in the woods. I wish it was Airwolf. That would have been great. While the Count is busy dealing with the vicar, the wolf grabs the girl and finishes the job Larry started, and he drags her away. Snuff realizes that this other wolf is, in fact, the great detective.
Which was teased out because when he saw the wolf was calling him Snuff. And then two minutes later, you know, he was in the tree with the binoculars going, "Snuff, wait, you saw that coming too as well, right?"
No.
Okay.
Because I think it's kind of silly that the great detective is also a werewolf.
Well, I think he just used, because he mentioned he was studying all of those flowers that Larry had. So yeah. Like he's using the flowers to turn into a werewolf. Hopefully it's not a permanent condition for him.
Well, I got the impression that he was also a werewolf. And since he was studying those flowers, because those flowers enabled Larry to control his condition.
Oh, so like he just was on the same track as Larry.
Yeah.
Because he is a werewolf, like the Hound of the Baskervilles bit him. And
for me, that's a little double mumbo jumbo, you know? It can't be Sherlock Holmes and a werewolf.
Obviously
you can.
This really happens, so what are you arguing with? But the vicar manages to take out the Count during all this by tossing some of the dirt from one of his own caskets at him. He's like over-consecrated it. So that messes the Count up, which was a novel approach. I was afraid the vicar would just like pull out a cross or something lame, which Dracula really should be able to predict at this point. So that was a unique way to go after Count Dracula.
The vicar can see that the sacrifice is gone and yells at Jill for not saying anything, but gets back into his position and continues.
Larry's not dead yet, though. He pulls himself up, sees the girl is gone. You know, even though he got hit by a silver bullet, it doesn't poison him. It's got to hit like a vital organ or something,
I guess.
So he's messed up, but he starts kind of pulling himself slowly toward the gate.
As the ritual continues, everyone begins to change forms. Reality warps and bends. Stars begin to fall from the sky. The moon turns red. Jack and Jill now point their wands at the gate. Chanting is coming from the fire itself.
But just then, Experiment Man lumbers into the ritual saying, "Pretty kitty," and gets in front of the gate, which interferes with the ritual a bit. But the Experiment Man doesn't even seem to notice as he picks up Gray Malk and walks away with her. She's like, "Hey, I'm trying to do something here." Classic Experiment Man. But this has only paused things. The gate is beginning to open.
A voice says, "This isn't working well." And it's Bubo the Rat.
Even though they warned him, "Don't get involved since you're not in the game," he smuggled himself in via Jack's pocket.
Yeah, there is a tentacle in the gate writhing around, and it reaches out and it takes Morris and McCab, slurping them up. Bubo confesses that he snuck out and he has swapped the wands, hoping to get them to defeat themselves since they seem so outnumbered.
He's a pack rat, and so he's going to help the pack. Jack's operating the opening wand, and Jill, without knowing it, has the closing wand.
That part didn't quite set well with me.
Well, how could you have predicted that? That's a little bit of the executive twist, isn't
That's
it?
That's an executive twist. And also, wouldn't they know? Wouldn't they sense that they're got the wrong wand and they're doing the wrong thing?
This says closing wand on it. Wait a minute.
It seemed very unlikely they wouldn't notice at some point that their wands were swapped because they're very important.
Yeah,
I don't
know. Let's not finish this book.
Okay. Snuff then remembers something the Dreamcat said to him. Carpe Baculum, seize the wand.
I don't think we mentioned that when we glossed over the Dreamland stuff.
We didn't.
It seemed a little insignificant, but I guess to argue against you saying this was kind of random. I mean, I guess that was a hint. Snuff thought the Dreamcat was just telling him to go chase a stick in Latin. But no, he was actually giving him that crucial piece of info he needed in this moment.
Right. So Snuff jumps up and he snatches the opening wand from Jack's hand. So I guess if they didn't swap wands, then it wouldn't have been in Jack's hand and he wouldn't have been able to get it. So I guess that is what the setup's about.
It's okay. I was okay with it.
This causes the gate to begin to collapse and Larry leaps up on the vicar, knocking him over and onto the Count, causing the icon to fall off his trapped body. Oh, right. He put Alhazred's icon on the Count's body to kind of keep him immobilized.
Right.
So he was able to, once that happened, he was able to get free. A wind sucks Larry and the vicar into the gate as it's closing.
Oh, poor Larry.
The monster picks up the Count's body and is not being sucked into the vortex.
Yeah, it's the monster holding the Count in his arms, just like I always dreamed when I was a kid. I always wanted something like that to happen. Yeah.
Well, this reminded me, too, of the vicar and Larry the werewolf kind of tumbling in. Isn't that the end of Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein? Isn't Dracula escaping and then the Wolfman leaps off the cliff after the bat and then they both tumble down?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, somebody let me know if I'm right about that.
But Experiment Man and the Count are okay. Vicar and Larry are in. They're gone. They went through the gate.
Jill is now realizing she has the wrong wand and Grey Malk tells her to get the hell out of there.
A single note as of a crushed crystal goblet filled the air. The stone was blank again. Abruptly, the wind ceased. The voices had already died away. We made our way northward to the slope. Overhead, the moon seemed enormous. "Let's go," Grey Malk urged as we came up beside her. And she was right. The hilltop would remain dangerous till dawn. I turned and looked back in time to see the experiment man start down the southern slope, carrying the Count. "Hi, Cat," I said. "I'll buy you that drink yet." "Hi, dog," she said. "I think I'll let you." Jack and Jill went down the hill. Grey and I ran after.
Zinger of a last line for the book. And didn't know that was coming. I made a joke about it in the last episode.
You didn't
spoil it for me.
I kept it tight. I didn't want to say a thing.
I think you're the real winner of this game, Chris.
Yay!
Which also means you're a murderer.
Oh no! That was a hell of a journey, and I want to thank Jason Rainbird for coming along.
Thanks so much, Jason, for all of your costume expertise, but you are also a great reader. Well, next month, we're going to swing back around to science fiction and fantasy, kicking it off with The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Yeah.
It's a very big story, and I just read it. It's really cool.
We'll also be covering Bellinia by J.G. Ballard and The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. The future is looking bright for next month. Or maybe dark.
Yeah.
I haven't read these yet. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting month. But don't forget that there's still a special bonus episode coming out for Devil's Night, October 30th. Woo. It's us chatting about Monster Squad. And you can listen to that or tune in for full hot video action.
Yeah.
We were able to record that episode because of our beautiful patrons. So let's thank some of them now. I'm going to supersize this one. Let's do another 15.
What?
I'm going to start by thanking Mark Ahenda.
I want to thank Benjamin Preston.
Stefan Larson, thank you.
Thank you, Crom Fuse.
Crom Fuse. Universal Head, thank you.
Shoggoth Lord, thank you so much.
Ellie Westcott, thank you.
Pony Fatagan, thank you.
Joe Boulay, thanks.
Katie Cole, thank you so much.
Gary Sinkick, thank you.
I'd like to thank Ali Oosterholm.
Daryl Hunt, thank you.
Ella Sheba, thank you.
Robert Reed, thank you. These are more longtime patrons, often are commenters on our feedback shows. We love them dearly.
Yes.
Thanks so much for participating, guys. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Happy Halloween, everybody. And hey, here's another track from the new Pitch Black Manor EP, Transylvania Kisses. This one is called Getting Spooky on the Dance Floor. You can grab it now from Bandcamp. We're linked out in the show notes.
Woo!
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
We're getting spooky on the dance floor.